As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to The Times. To find out more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti and I'm excited for so many reasons this week. And most of them having to do with the fact that Rory K. Smith isn't back yet. No, I'm actually more excited. We miss Rory. With me in the studio today is the excellent Tony Cascarino and award-winning writer, or you wrote a book with an award-winning writer.
Yes.
He's the award winner and you're the guy who supplied the stories. It would be Paul Kimmage.
Yes.
There you go.
Sir Paul Kimmage.
Has he been knighted, really?
No, I just...
I thought he was Irish.
I'm going to knight him. Yeah, well, that's
can
why
Irish people be knighted?
Sir Bob Geldof, there you go.
That other voice you heard, of course, is not the one with the French accent, is Alison Rudd, who joined us again. She's a little bit under the weather, so please bear with her. And finally, of course, we have Julian Lorenz. Coming up, we'll be discussing Jurgen Klopp's first loss against Alan Pardew's Palace, Leicester's remarkable form, as well as the usual quick hits. But first, let's talk about the North London Derby. Alison, I'm going to start with you. Going into this game, Arsenal were coming off a 5-1 spanking that probably could have been 10-1 in the Champions League. But in some ways, it was good to have the Spurs game next because it kind of gave you an immediate sense to show, or an immediate chance rather, to show that what we saw in Munich wasn't the real Arsenal and you could come back in a way that perhaps a home tie against Norwich or Sunderland couldn't have. I thought Arsenal got killed early on.
Yeah, they could have done with a home tie against Norwich or Sunderland. That's what they needed, Gab, not a home tie against Spurs, who, if you're going down the theoretical what they needed path, Spurs, having played Thursday night, probably didn't need the North London derby. I mean, everyone knows Europa League is such an exhausting campaign anyway.
They played Monday night and Thursday night, I might add. Three games in 7 days. Thank you, Premier League schedulers.
Well, exactly.
They couldn't work out the fact that Spurs were going to be in the... in the Europa League, it's hard
days?
To tell.
Is it six?
I think you'll find it's seven. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday brings us to seven. Thank you.
It's getting too highbrow for me. But anyway,
Cascarino's actually counting on his fingers as we speak.
Can I also
point out, right? This is what I don't understand about you, Cass. You've played poker professionally for real money, right? Mm. So presumably you can handle complicated calculations in your mind, but counting to seven is a bit more challenging.
Are you looking to undermine me here?
No, I just find this duality fascinating.
Well, I was sort of, you know, it's back to it was Monday night, so it's probably in between lunchtime kickoff.
Yeah, do you count the Monday when the game is Monday night?
Yeah, so it's sort of nearly Tuesday. It's only a couple of hours from, well, 4 hours from Tuesday. So now
six,
am I...
6¾ days, isn't it?
Yeah.
Julian, you see the state of the Anglo media. Please bring some continental logic to this.
Yes.
I haven't even finished speaking yet. It's been interrupted by adding up.
I apologise.
Should we do nursery rhymes next?
No, go on.
Okay. No, I was simply going to say, if you were to put the build-up for each club, it was tougher still for Tottenham, and yet they were the team that looked fresher and... technically better.
It's not often that Arsenal play teams that are technically better. Is it true?
Yeah, it's true. It's true. There haven't been that many, especially at the Emirates, playing the way Spurs played for 70 minutes. I mean, I think Arsenal played with 10 men in the first half because Santi Cazorla was completely out of it. Came on at half-time for dizziness and clearly not being well. So I think there was a bit of that. I think there was a bit of Arsenal not really physically being ready for what's coming, which is weird because you just had to watch the last few games from Spurs knowing that this is exactly how they were going to play. So it looks like Arsenal were not really sure exactly how Spurs were going to play and got surprised by how high they were pressing, how quick they got pressing around the board to get it back, how you know, how Dele Alli and Dyer were working in midfield, Dembele, Eriksen, the movement Kane had, which is always the same. That first goal, surely they should have...
It was terrible.
but surely they should have known that's exactly the kind of thing that Spurs would bring to that, to this game. And it looked like Arsenal were not ready for that, which is hard to believe.
Cass, the remarkable thing with this, though, is that as badly as Arsenal played for 70 minutes, or as well as Tottenham played for 70 minutes, Giroud still had a grab bag of chances. In fact, we bumped into one Ian Wright outside, who was...
quite vocal.
Vocal, yes. Not too happy with Giroud's performance. What gets me is Arsenal playing this badly with so many guys out, with Alexis Sanchez totally anonymous or whatever, with really, I thought, only Ertzel and maybe one or two others from starting 11 really playing well, they created enough chances to win this game.
Well, I think the strange thing was that, you know, we always associate Arsenal with moving the ball, brilliant technique on individuals. And set pieces were a problem for Spurs. They really looked, didn't they? They looked like they were going to score every time they got one, Arsenal. And when it came in, it was literally get the ball in the box. And funny enough, Bayern Munich, the home game, when Giroud scores his header, that sort of ball's becoming more prominent for Arsenal. And they're playing in a style that Giroud is the most effective. But he hasn't finished off two or three glorious chances. And like you said, bumping into Wrighty, he had made a really good point, which was... he hasn't got Theo pressurising him. Sometimes as a centre forward, you don't have pressure on you. You can be a little bit lazy and a little bit just not as hungry. And
I'll defer to you on this because you are a professional centre forward, unlike me. Do you actually get lazy when you know that, like, you're,
you
know,
the other stuff? I think you can do. Yeah, I
that happened to you?
My own career, yeah. I think I got slightly. I was the top goal scorer leading into the 90 World Cup qualifying campaign. And I sort of guaranteed my place in the World Cup 90 and remember thinking...
For the Republic, this is for the Republic of Ireland.
Yeah, and I didn't quite play as well and just thought I wouldn't be left out. And Big Quinny came in from nowhere and Jack saw it immediately. And he actually said to me, he said, you need a bit more pressure on you. You think you're just a certain star. And I always remember that World Cup because I remember looking at Vialli at the... We played Italy. He was on the bench for Italy because Scalacci had come in. And I think Vialli had gone into that comment. I think you do sometimes, centre forward. If you don't have that pressure of fighting for your shirt and another player really pushing you, you know that if I don't play well there, don't score, sometimes you can be a little bit lackadaisical. And I certainly felt Giroud, I sort of got what Wrighty was saying about Giroud against Spurs.
I'll be sure to let Luca know that you think his benching in the 1990 World Cup was due to him being a little bit lazy and not the fact that he broke his foot a month before the, competition.
Gab,
I'm kidding. Yeah. I take your point on that. Let's talk about Spurs a little bit because... we've praised them so much. Many people praise them for just the sheer youth of this lineup. I think I'm right in saying that the outfield players that Spurs have actually used this season in the Premier League, every single one is age 25 or younger, except for Alderweireld, Vertonghen,
Dembele,
Lloris. I think there might have been one other guy, but this is a team that, in theory, could be together for another 4 or 5 years. At the same time, though, the reason it's working with Pochettino is because, you know, Pochettino's a very good manager and he's got guys who've taken on board the way he wants them to play and all this stuff. But also, he doesn't like big personalities. And he doesn't like people who are also a little bit nasty. Sometimes difficult to manage, big voice. Like, he wouldn't necessarily like a John Terry, for example, in his team. They're not quite choir boys, but everybody in the Spurs lineup seems like somebody who's thoroughly pleasant, with the possible exception of Ryan Mason and Fazio. And Fazio doesn't play and Mason doesn't start anymore.
Ben Taleb, neither.
And the two centre backs especially, like, I don't want to say they're soft, but certainly that's the perception point. Is that, I mean, did you see a merit in this, Julian? I mean, is that...
And I think he's been like that everywhere he's been. And it could be a problem when, I think, to win big things, you need big characters in your dressing room. It's great to have Dele Alli and Eric Dyer and Vertonghen and Alderweireld and all of that, or Lloris even. But I think there's a point where you need a bit of nastiness, you need a bit of big character, you need also the dressing
room. Alli looks like he has personality.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying about personality, I'm saying
he's
like...
He's 19, big, though. Yeah. He's not nasty, or maybe we haven't seen the nasty side of him.
But maybe he comes a bit later in Pochettino's process as a manager. Right. You know, maybe he comes... Maybe for the squads he's had so far and the way he wanted them to play... You start that way, and then when everything is a bit more established, when you know you're in the top four already, when you are really fighting to win the league or win a European Cup or whatever, maybe that that's the next stage, maybe.
I wonder if we in the media, again, yeah, speaking from your experience, do you need the guy who will go and do something dirty or go and shout at the players in the dressing room?
Well, I'm thinking of all teams and thinking of the obvious, the Man United, the Gerrards and Liverpools and whatever. And I'm sort of thinking, well, where's Man City's? Have they really got a guy that's that nasty?
I would argue Otamendi.
I think Fernando.
Fernando? I'm talking going when they won the title 2 or 3 years ago. Would you have said that they were had some real nasty characters in their team? I would say that they're... I mean, I'm just trying to be devil's advocate here. I'm thinking that, look, we associate success with sometimes having a particular type of character within your team, going back to 66 and a Nobby Styles.
No, but not just the Nobby Styles, but I mean also because you can also have the veteran leader in your team. Mm. And
you know, Gary McAllister that Liverpool had, you know, that type. Right.
City have had Vincent Kompany, of course, you know, in terms of that kind of leadership.
Until a team wins something that is completely nice all the way through. I mean, I've even watched the likes of Barcelona and we saw Mascherano. Mascherano fouls people for fun and is as nasty as anything in a tat challenge. Do you know a team that's achieved real huge success without having certain characters within their team? Because I can't think of too many.
I'd have to really. I mean, I spent actually a bit of time thinking about it. I mean, the difficult thing is obviously from the outside is that unless you spend time really talking to players on the team and so on, you don't actually know, right? Because there's also players who are psychopathic on the pitch and off the pitch, they're the nicest people in the world. Equally, there are players who are genuine leaders on the pitch, but you don't see that off the pitch in the way that, you know, so it's...
tough.
It's tough to tell.
Dembele yesterday
but, I mean, certainly, when we talk about midfield and spine and all this jazz, you know, the veteran leadership, you know. It's Dele Alli, who's 19, and Eric Dyer, who's 20. I mean, he's another one who, certainly when he came, I mean, the perception at Everton before he went to Portugal was that he was you know, a nice guy, gifted, but really, really soft, you know? And it's not like he got harder in Portugal.
I do wonder, yesterday, when the game started turning, if he had someone in midfield with a bit more experience, a bit more established, instead of Dele Alli and Dyer, who played great. They played really well for 70 minutes. But after that, this time, I'm not sure they really know exactly how to control that game and just to get it... Yeah. You know, over the line to win it.
Unfortunately, he liked neither Etienne Capoue or Stambouli.
You can be a little bit soft, to quote you back, Gab, if you do a lot of that pressing and high energy game, because you don't have time to think about how soft you are. And the opposition are intimidated in a different sort of way. They're intimidated by the closing down of space and the fact that you're always in their face. And they don't have to be nasty people to do that. It's just they're following instructions.
The intimidation was done by how they pressed, the tempo of the game. I mean, no one got even a second on the ball on the Arsenal side
game, though. What happens when you're not on top of the game? Like they were for the last 25 minutes or half an hour, where, okay, the pressing is not as efficient as it used to be earlier because, one, you're tired, because the other team has found a way somehow to come back in the game. If you don't have a bit of that nastiness to somehow get the ball back by tackling a bit more or by getting more physical, then you lose the grip on the game.
I just want to say one thing on that, Julian, that I think the game is evolving where, more often than not, you're going to be getting second yellow cards and red cards. And I think in the next 10 years, it's going to be a bigger problem for teams keeping 10 people on the pitch. So having nasty people out there, a lot of these Keynes and all the people we're talking about, wouldn't be lasting the 90 minutes anymore.
Right, but not nasty as in breaking... Yeah,
no,
breaking legs.
But look at Flamini. Consistent fouling.
Flamini brought Arsenal back in the game, coming on at half-time and just, you know, making tackles there and there everywhere before moving to right back. Brought his team back because suddenly they weren't winning the ball back. They were winning challenges, 50-50s, duels, whatever you want to call it. And they were back in that game.
Isn't it a wonderful game, though, where you expect, like, if we were to tell you, like, Mathieu Flamini will be save Arsenal in a North London derby 2 months ago, you would have thought, like, what? What kind of weirdo parallel universe is that going to happen?
But a level-headed Flamini is better than a dizzy Cazorla.
All right. We need to broach the subject now because it's an annual subject with Tottenham. I think I'm right in saying they finish between fourth and sixth every year for a long time. Is this the year? I mean, given that they're young and growing, if you look at the table, Alice has just put on her glasses for that very purpose, so I can inform you if you don't have one handy. City and Arsenal are on 26 points. Leicester's on 25. United are on 24. For those who are Big Six obsessed, the main reason to think that Spurs could maybe make it into the top four is that Liverpool are 4 points back on 17 and Chelsea are a million points back on -8. Is this the year? I need a percentage chance. I know you love percentage chances.
Alison doesn't like that.
Okay, you can redeem yourself for counting to seven before. Percentage, because you understand percentages. Percentage chance that...
Spurs to make top four?
Yeah.
75.
75% chance.
Wow. They'll get in front. Why? They'll get in front of Leicester. I think their biggest danger is Southampton, and I don't think that the gap that Chelsea have got can bridge. I think Tottenham have got a great chance of making.
Presumably,
you don't
see Liverpool making the top four.
I think it'll be very tough for them. I still think there's a lot of work for Klopp to be done. Not because they lost yesterday, but I still think.
Well, we'll get to Liverpool in a minute. Yeah. In a minute, Alison.
Around 35%, maybe less, because I can just feel the Groundhog Day moment coming. They're going to get sapped by the Europa. It's going to be exactly like last season.
They've got West Ham next week, Chelsea the week after. I think after those two games, we'll know a bit more about them. I say 50-50. I agree with Cass. I think Liverpool and Southampton, we give them a good run for their money.
Moving on to where we want to be, to a team that's won it five times or so, I'm told. Liverpool and Crystal Palace. It's a sad day for people who aren't Alan Pardew fans. It's a sad day for Liverpool fans because Jurgen Klopp, I believe this is his first defeat. And it's a defeat at Anfield as well. Alison, it seems appropriate to begin with you.
What?
Do you want Rodgers back yet?
No, there's a really... funniest thing I've heard in a long time. No, there's a very weird after stench to this game, and I'm not quite sure what's going on. Liverpool played well. They created many more chances than Palace. It wasn't a dreadful performance, and yet, because the combination of it was raining, Stevie G was back, there was supposed to be a point to prove because Rodgers was defeated by Palace at the end of last season. Klopp had yet to lose. All those things, plus the fact that some fans left early, has left this sort of stain on the game, as though it's a huge disaster. Anyone who thinks you're going to take over a team with players he's inherited, Klopp, they're pretty average. I'll tell you what, if I was a manager and I could just choose a group of players to manage and then give them a name, I might go for Palace's group of players rather than Liverpool's, to be perfectly honest, in terms of the potential there and what they can inflict on a team. There's a lot, there's a gap, there's gaps in the Liverpool team. The fact that Klopp is left saying, oh, I felt alone, and isn't it, oh, it's sad, and people were telling us we were tired and maybe we're listening to them. And the narrative should be that maybe Klopp's identified Europe as an area he can do really well in because he's got fantastic experience, unlike his predecessor, who just gave up on Europe every time he was in it. I think most Liverpool fans would be happy if he won the Europa League and finished top six. It's not, or, and the Capital One Cup. I mean, come on, it's one league game in which Benteke just looked off form. That's all it was.
Okay, so nothing to be concerned about because it created chances. And you're on board with that?
I think it's not that concerning.
You're not on board with her point that you would rather have Palace's squad of players than Liverpool's?
Okay. No, although I think Palace have done really well in the summer to recruit. I think Sako is a very clever move. I think Kabay, obviously, as well. I'd still rather to have the Liverpool squad. But I think it's just work in progress. You know, it was never going to be easy for Klopp to arrive, and despite the win at Chelsea, to arrive and suddenly this Liverpool team to play like the Dortmund that did the double, for example, in Germany under Klopp. It's never going to be like that. It would always take time. And I would say to Jorgen, who's listening to the podcast, I know every Monday, welcome to England. That's what happens. People leave their seats early. It's not just that Liverpool, it's in a lot of stadiums.
But
just,
do you not? I don't think Jurgen's that stupid. I think he knows people leave stadiums. I think he thought Liverpool is a special club where the fans do not leave early. Jurgen Klopp was disappointed at the fans leaving early. They left. What time was Scott Dan's gone? Well, that's 2-1. That. How many times have people been at Anfield and seen the Liverpool team come back, the training, only by one goal? We're talking about one goal.
That was against Olympiacos when Gerrard was on the pitch.
Liverpool are very good traditionally at coming back from adversity. They'd created a lot of chances. The expectation surely would be they might create at least two more decent ones in the time left. You know, the famous cop, they would suck the ball into the back of the net. When he said he felt isolated because people were leaving early once Scott Dan's header had gone in, I don't think he's naive in terms of thinking, ooh, I didn't realise people left games early in England. He knows that perfectly well. I think he thought Liverpool was a special club where the fans almost dictated results because of their passion. And you're not going to dictate anything if you're leaving your seat.
By the way, every time I go to Gillingham, I never ask for a ticket. My first club, I always go and pay for it.
Right, but I'm assuming there's much traffic to beat when you go to Gillingham.
Well, no, there's not much traffic. Okay. But well, I'm with these. You can't leave. How can you leave 2-1 down and there's like 10 minutes to go or whatever? I just find it amazing that fans would want to go to a game and their team is just gone one behind. Surely they need their fans to try and lift the team again and get something in the last few minutes. I find it really weird.
Let's talk Palace, because the Alan Pardew bandwagon rolls on. He's beaten some big teams away from home. You're raising your finger. You want to...
He fancied his chances there. He went into that game knowing what a great time to play Liverpool, like he did when Chelsea. I know that Alan spoke to people privately before they played Chelsea at Selhurst Park, at the Bridge, and fancied their chances, said we could get a result today. And I absolutely know that Alan felt what a great time to play Liverpool. They've beaten Chelsea the Sunday previously. They go to Ruben Cazal on, what was it, Thursday night. And the way that they like to play, counter-attack with pace. Bolasie was causing all sorts of problems, as he can do. They still had to do the job, but they did.
Let's take Wilf Saha. I mean, this is incredible man management, if you like. He's still, you know, on the cusp of being a great
player.
Never
ever met Moyes' daughter, as I discovered from your piece.
Yes, well, I'm bringing him up because I sat down with Wilf a couple of weeks ago and this was sanctioned.
Now, yeah?
Sorry?
You call him Wilf.
Yes, we call him Wilf, those who know him well. And the decision to let him meet, he met with three members of the press, and that was, Wilf said yes, he'd do it, and then Pardew said, yeah, I'm happy for him to do it. And there was a general sense around the club, oh, it's slightly surprising, just on the eve of playing Man United, all you're going to get is grief from that sort of interview, because it's clearly going to be either about how rubbish Man United were to let him go, or he might slag off a United player or manager or something. But they said, yes, he can sit down with you. And Zaha did say that United were dreadful to him. He had a horrible time and he was never told how to improve or what he could do to get in the team. And all that happened were rumours developed about why he wasn't in the team. All of them were untrue. And he just was very deeply unhappy. And the headline stuff was, he said, I'd never even met David Moyes' daughter, because there was speculation that he must have slept with her and that's why he was being dumped by the manager. It all got quite nasty. But after that interview came out, Pardew wasn't cross at all. He took the view, this has unburdened Zaha. He's got this all off his chest. He sort of dragged the poison out of his body. He can now concentrate on being a Palace player, giving it everything. Instead of being inhibited and worrying about things, he can just go for it now. He's a grown-up now. He said what he had to say. I'm going to back him. I think, and he said publicly, I think he dealt very well with the question.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Asked in the interview and so on and so on.
Page 11 of the game, next to an excellent column on Karim Benzema, there's pictures of Jurgen Klopp and Alan Pardew on the sidelines, and this great picture where it looks like Pardew is kind of time traveling back to the late 90s and doing the whole like talk to the hand because the face ain't listening thing to Pardew. Did you see the photo? It's absolutely brilliant. If you get a chance to see it, Palace are playing really well this year, and I think the criticism sometimes he's chosen a way of playing. And it's proving, and he's being proven right.
I'm warming up. I'm listening to Johan Cabal, who tells me, you know, we work really hard. He's very clever in all his approach. Take the United game at home. Cabal says, we knew what we had to do. You block Martial. You're not going to concede. We can play on the counter-attack. They controlled that game very well. It was very clever. They got the point they wanted. It was fair point. They didn't play great that day, but because they were on a different approach. Yesterday, on Sunday, they went for a different game plan that worked as well. I think he has different game plans, which is very good. So I'm kind of warming up the idea.
There's also the game plan he had at Newcastle, of course, which is a whole other issue as well.
But I think Cabaye is key. Cabaye has been the key player, more than Wilf, more than Bolasie, more than Sako, who, again, I said it was a very clever signing. I think Cabaye has been key.
Let's move on to somebody who is 1 point off the top of the table with a team that, 7 months ago, something like that, everybody was sure was going to get relegated because they were dead last. They've made some additions in the summer, but really, and I think actually they've contributed in big ways. But what struck me most about Leicester City this season is how there are people. I mean, Mark Albrighton, who's a guy that maybe gets talked about less than Vardy or Mahrez, I think is playing as well maybe as he's ever played. Defensively, I think they're very good. And this is a team and that was really down in the dumps. Now, you remember, I'm a Pearson fan. I'd rather go on holiday with Nigel Pearson than with Alan Pardew, personally. I think we all would. Maybe not Pat Murphy, but most other people
would. Why would you want to go on holiday with any of them?
Because I find Nigel Pearson handsome and engaging. You wouldn't want to go on holiday with what?
No.
What, they skeeve you?
No, I wouldn't want to go on holiday. I'd rather go on holiday with my family.
Would you go on holiday with Kajo Ranieri? That could be fun.
That would be fun. We could go and make pizza together. We'd have big
Louis
giggles.
Louis van Gaal, would you go and do with him?
No, actually, I'd love to spend time to try and understand.
Can you
better.
Give us a list of your top 10 I'd go on holiday with managers plus locations?
That might be a project for another week.
Really?
The point is, Leicester are 1 point off the top, and some players have really improved, and I think this manager deserves a little bit of credit because everybody was joking and laughing. Ha, the Tinker Man, crazy Claudio. Look, he's making pizza. What a weirdo.
No one's. He's been loved since he's got.
When he was appointed? Come on.
No, the appointment felt ridiculous because of his experience with Greece. Everyone thought he's lost it. How can you lose at home to what, the Faroe Islands, was it? I mean, that's ridiculous.
But isn't it kind of ridiculous and idiotic to go and judge somebody based on six games, however many it was?
With the Greece national team.
Yeah, but I'm explaining why.
It was a left field appointment. He wasn't arriving back in the Premier League on the back of having done something well at internationally or with a club.
Well, it was Monaco before, which was not too bad.
Not just that, he also finished second in Serie A with Juventus and with Roma since leaving Chelsea.
I'm not saying he's a bad manager. I'm saying that is why it surprised people.
Perception. No, but this is the thing, right? But you have to. It surprised foolish people who, because okay, I take your point. If he was a no-name manager, right, a guy, some dude nobody's ever heard of, if he was Takis Papadopoulos, who goes and manages Greece and then they lose and But this is a guy who had a CV, right? So you shouldn't be surprised necessarily that they would go for somebody who has a long and decent CV and who obviously lost some bad games with the national team. But you're not going to judge him on 4 to 6 games, especially when managing a national team is so different than managing a club side, right?
I agree with you completely. I'm just trying to explain why there was this initial surprise.
So, Julian, why are they good?
Well, they're good because Jamie Vardy is walking on water, clearly. You know, it's quite incredible. People knew he was talented, especially after the end of last season. I just don't think anyone could have predicted him being in the form he is right now. It's simply incredible.
Scored in 9 consecutive games.
When I see that Gökhan İnle, who arrived in the summer, doesn't play much, it tells you how strong they are in midfield. And I'm going to give a love to a former Ligue 1 player, Ben N'Golo Kanté, who they signed from Caen in the summer again, who no one had never heard of in this country, because in this country not many people watch foreign football. Thinking like, who on earth is this guy that we've never heard of, and we paid, you know, a fair amount of money. And I think not just because of the goal at the weekend, but overall I think he's been great for them. And Riyad Mahrez as well, once again a former player in France, has been outstanding. And I think
he was outstanding last season too, just that nobody noticed.
The good thing about Claudio, and it was exactly the same at Monaco, is that yes, maybe his training sessions are not the best, they're not Pep's training sessions, but he gets the best out of everybody because he's warm, because the players like him, because he get that player-manager sort of relationship that not many managers have. And they like playing for him and they want to play for him. The fans are great. And I think once you start well, you get that momentum that keeps you even when you're not on a good day.
See, end of last season, Leicester played Hull City, home game, and it finished 0-0. And the game was really negative. And I thought it was a changing moment because Nigel Pearson, from that moment, went quite aggressive in the style he wanted to play. Leicester went on a run towards the end of last season and eventually kept them up. And that way of playing has stayed with them this year. I mean, Vardy and Mahrez...
Do you think there was a change there? Because,
yeah,
again,
I
don't want to go back to last season. No, but Leicester were last. But they were being really... They were in the middle part of the season. They were really, really unlucky.
Mm.
And that's why I think Pearson's actually a very good manager. I know he's got perhaps other issues. They were much better. Their performances were much better than their results. And over time, when your performances are better than results, you improve. In the same way that if you've been lucky, you regress to the mean, right?
I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Gab. Their performances didn't merit them being where they were. But with what's happened is that, I mean, I'm looking at Vardy. He's, you know, leading the goal scorer. Then you have Mahrez, who's second top goal scorer. Leicester have scored more goals than Arsenal, Man United, Chelsea and quite a few other clubs. I think they're only second to Man City in the goal scoring charts. It's like, wow, this is like the eighth wonder of the world at the moment because they are just doing everything. They're goal scoring, they concede. We know they were. I did a piece when they played Arsenal and I knew it was a really funny, horrible game for them when they lost to Arsenal at home. But I love their bravery of not being afraid to try and win a game. And when you've got Vardy just running on the back, he's like Craig Bellamy at his best. You know when Craig would just bomb past people, just chase things down and keep going? I'll ask you one question. I might have asked you this a couple of weeks ago because some people are surprised. The age difference between Rooney and Vardy.
I think Rooney's 2 years older.
Yeah. Vardy 21, 29 28, next month in January. No?
There's 14 months difference between their birthdays. And you're sort of thinking, I know Wayne's played
more games,
a lot younger age, but you see, sort of think, this guy's 29 years old and he's running his backside off
and scaring the
life out of people.
Does anybody know the Jamie Vardy story? I mean, just for our listeners who don't.
Yeah, I know most of it.
Can you tell us? Because basically,
what you mean, non-league from Fleetwood?
Right. Even before, I mean, this guy was 16. He was ditched by Sheffield Wednesday, and he spent a lot of time in non-league football. And if you go, at least according to Wikipedia, he scored tons of goals for all these Diddy teams, Steel Town Steelers, whatever the hell they were called. And he moved up to different crummy conference
teams.
Every
level got better and better.
Right, but it took him a long, long time. Mm. When somebody, I mean, you look at it, once he scored like 41 goals or something in conference, and I wonder what was the issue about. I mean, when you see that, you would assume, okay, this guy's 21 years old. He scored a ton of goals. You know, maybe Wednesday missed out on him, but, you know, me, championship team, I'll go and sign him. And then he does well. And then he goes, like, why did it take him so long? Why did it take so long for English football to realize that this guy was good? Also, because at that level, he was so much better than the people he played against. They would wind him up and then he'd always respond. And people thought he was a bit of a head case.
There was a period where very few teams were taking players from non-league. And when they'd go from non-league, they'd go the route of League 2, League 1. And when was a Premier League team going to take a non-league player? It just doesn't happen anymore.
But he didn't even go League 2, League 1. That's what's weird.
What I'm trying to say is that obviously Nigel Pearson was the ultimate one because he took the gamble with him. He saw, $800,000? He was a record for a non-league player, wasn't he, at the time, his transfer fee. That he sees something in him. Now, a lot of people might have looked at his negatives and he does this, oh, he's crazy, he's mad, which many scouts and many people who watch football will say, avoid him. He's not right upstairs. Right?
Was that the charge? Does anybody actually know, or are we all just speculating?
Well, it was always... Well, seemingly, we're not seeing that. All we're seeing is now is a guy that's literally scaring the pants off of every defender because they're just watching him literally run and run and run behind them, and he hurts you. He's quite an old-fashioned way of playing. And I first saw him in Russia. I used to say, this guy scares the life out of defenders because he just runs behind him all the time at incredible pace, and Vardy does that. He never, ever, he's relentless.
I mean, he's obviously a very quick player, but he's not somebody who just relies on the pace. I think there's an intelligence to his movement. There's an ability to sniff out space.
And a good finisher.
Which is pretty instinctive.
Yeah.
And a good finisher
And
as
a bit
well.
Of love for his first touch on the penalty he got against Watford on Saturday, because that first touch, the way he took it down, was incredible. And I don't think many players, even in the Premier League, could have done that at that pace.
And how beautiful that Mahrez went to take the penalty, then thought twice.
Yeah.
Mahrez really is the person we'd all want to be, but know that we can never be.
How would you call Mahrez?
call him?
Yeah, Riri, because we have had Wilf. How would you call Riyad Mahrez? If you knew him well,
I don't know him well enough to shorten his name.
Riri.
I just on that final point, he's probably very fortunate as well that he's in a very good side that suits him, and he's become a vocal point of the way that Leicester want to play. And it just fits for him. It's fitted perfectly the way that, you know, you could go to another team and he might not be allowed to do the sort of things he's doing at Leicester. Their goal scoring is phenomenal, just not him, but as a team.
Can we just address, seeing as this is supposed to be about why Leicester are doing so well, can we just address who they've played? They've had a very nice start to the season.
They've got,
please tell us.
And when they've had the difficult game, which was Arsenal in form,
at home.
The plan of action was, you've got the day off, boys, do what you want.
Isn't that wonderful?
That's what it was.
A manager liberating the players.
Well, he can't do that every time they play a team who's big and
true.
On form.
It is a good point.
Yeah. Oh, they've got City, Chelsea. I mean, not Chelsea, it's a real tough one at the moment. But I think Liverpool, Man U, they've got all them coming the next game.
Okay, but they're 1 point off the top of the freaking table, yeah? I mean, that doesn't change, yes? Nobody wants to do percent chances of Leicester staying in the top four, I'm assuming.
What? Leicester finishing in the top four?
Yeah.
No, they won't.
Top six? It's still a good story.
Yeah.
I will leave you with your percent chance that this former Chelsea manager finishes higher than the man who replaced him at Chelsea back in 2004.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Okay.
So what's the... How many points ahead of...
They're 14 points ahead of Chelsea, and we have 26 games to go. Cass?
Coin flip, Chelsea.
50-50.
Yeah.
No, Chelsea will just squeeze ahead of them.
I don't think so. I think Leicester will finish above Chelsea, yeah.
Showing some love for Claudio.
Yeah.
Right, enough of this. Moving on to some quick hits. Chelsea travel to Stoke and lose again, albeit without the suspended Jose Mourinho. But Alisson, this time they actually looked decent and played well.
Yes, they did. And Hazard, most people who were there with me, thought it was Hazard's best game of the season for Chelsea. But in a way, that made it worse for Chelsea, I thought, because, yes, they were quite classy and elegant and they played some nice stuff. Didn't know how to react to going a goal behind. Hazard's shoulders did droop a little. They started to look a bit fragile. And they played in an inhibited way, which meant they completely gave up on the wings and tried to sort of do little passes through the middle, and Stoke were all over that. It was sort of double-edged, the fact that it was quite a nice performance, because they couldn't change when they had to. There's something deeply fragile about the team.
Okay, Alison, so basically you're saying that because Chelsea played well without Mourinho, they should just sack him, right?
I could go on for about 20 minutes now as to why. They should have actually taken advantage of Mourinho not being there and offered something different off the bench. But he was so such a control freak about not letting his coaching team have any say at all in what happened, that they missed a trick, I think.
Speaking of Stoke, and okay, I should point out, I asked you to prepare for this question, so I'm expecting a great story. Speaking of Stoke, I was stuck by the humorous Ryan Shawcross, Diego Costa, stinky armpits routine. Uncle Cass, I'm sure you have some neat anecdote to tell us. Who was the most foul-smelling centre-back who ever marked you?
When I read the question, I was like, really? You expect me to say someone? I think it's really disrespectful. What Costa did, I just think it really makes me feel funny about professional footballers who'd, you know, I just find it strange. I just find it, and I'm not going to say anybody.
Was there anybody without naming names? Were you ever somebody getting contacted?
I never remember that. No, I was trying to play my game. I never really thought about how someone smelt during it. I just found it a really strange thing for Costa to do. I just thought, don't like that. Just didn't like it. And I don't really want to.
Nobody's ever wound you up in that way by pretending you stink or.
I don't remember, Gab, because when I read it, I thought, do I remember anybody doing that? No. And would I have done anything? No. And no, I have never had anybody do it to me either.
All right. Well, obviously you played in a kinder, gentler time, didn't you? Remy Gard halts the rot, snatching a draw on his debut against top-of-the-table Manchester City, no less. Julian Pellegrini said City dominated, but were simply unlucky. Is he being mean to your countrymen?
He's being very mean, San Pellegrino. I don't know why. Give the guy a bit of credit, a bit of encouragement. You know, yes, they rode their luck a bit, but they were well organised, they worked hard, and it was a good point for him to start.
Manchester United don't exactly entertain the masses, but they keep another clean sheet, and they get 3 points against West Brom. Alisson, I'm directing a question at you because there's a court order against Julian from answering this. It's fair to say that the current Van Gaal isn't the Van Gaal you were expecting, and maybe it's not the Van Gaal was expecting either.
Well, if you look at who he's managed some of the most exciting teams in the world. Ajax, Barcelona, the Dutch national team. So, yeah, Van Gaal, you'd think, oh, he'd come into Man United and make them just as exciting. But then if you were to say who are the most pragmatic managers who've ever managed Ajax or Barcelona or the Dutch national side, you would say Van Gaal. So, in a way, it's not that surprising, is it?
Did you call Van Gaal pragmatic?
Yeah, he puts...
Oh, really interesting.
He puts most result people, before flair.
Most people would suggest that other than the Dutch World Cup side, which was totally a pragmatic side, I don't think anybody would dispute that. Most of his career, the argument against him has been that he's been the opposite of pragmatic, that he's actually been such an idealist and with his ideas of football and so on, and he's been so inflexible. And that was both part of his genius and his great failing. The Sunday Times reported how a bunch of leading footballers, including Danny Murphy, Rio Ferdinand, Martin Keown, were hit extremely hard by the collapse of an investment scheme, stroke legal tax avoidance scheme, which involved, I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of it, but you can go and read it, or you can read Matthew Syed's excellent column on it. Kevin Campbell, for one, lost £7 million, which I'm assuming is pretty close to what Kevin Campbell made in his career. Cass, are footballers easy prey for folks willing to gamble with their earnings?
Yes, they are. Many schemes. I know many players. I know a number of players. I know a particular friend now who's talking to me, another scheme that's gone pear-shaped that hasn't been mentioned in the last few days because it's only just come alight. We have advisors, which I think are more dangerous than agents because agents seem to help you or try and get you a move to clubs. But advisors, driving in brand new cars, they charge you huge fees, commissions. But I also would add that I think there are a lot of footballers who are very lazy with what they should be doing with their investments, their funds of what they've made over their career. Because sometimes people just slip a document underneath you who they've known you for 10 years and they say, just sign that, it's just to transfer your money from one fund to another. But it might cost you 10% of that fund. And there'll be a lot more stories to come in the next few years about even bigger amounts.
For somebody to go and do this, I think there has to be a relationship of trust.
Yes,
with your financial advisor. And
well, there's one particular case that I'd mentioned that the trust was abused, and the abuse has cost a lot of people lots of money because the person's going to get in trouble. But these are all things that have been happening for years. I've did it in a very small level because I like to do things myself. But I do think that I go back to one point. Gab, I think there's a number of footballers who are very lazy because you can employ solicitors or people like who know the ups and the downsides of a particular document or an investment, which players tend to trust someone a little bit too much.
I believe there's also the PFA also has some kind of
absolutely.
Equivalent of a citizens advice bureau. So footballers, if you're
but
listening
it's not
to
just
this,
footballers. There's many, and I chatted to Alison about this. There's lots of people you'd be surprised in the entertainment world and other parts of the world, you know, big business where they get involved as well.
Bournemouth lose at home, but it's one of the most one-sided games you'll see, or one of the most one-sided games I've seen recently, as they absolutely dominate Newcastle, and only a tremendous performance from keeper Robbie Elliott, who wasn't even supposed to play. He was carrying a knock. Julian, is this a sign, though, that going back to the whole argument about performances and results, that Bournemouth will pull off a great escape?
I think it is. It is a big sign. I've got loads of time and love and faith in and for Eddie Howe and Bournemouth. I think they're going to sign. They were very unlucky with injuries.
Mings, Wilson,
Grado.
Yeah.
So I think their strength, they buy a few people in January, and I really believe they will stay up.
Really?
Really.
Or it wasn't just that the performance was so good because Newcastle are so god-awful and God is still punishing Steve McLaren.
Yeah, and I'm sure I would have the Crystal Palace squad ahead of the Newcastle squad, although it's not too bad.
Gab, one for you. There were derbies all over the place in Europe. Rome derby, Ruhr derby, and Lyon v Saint-Etienne. Tell us about all of them, but briefly.
Right, the Rome Derby was played without the ultras in a surreal atmosphere because they're angry about crowd segregation. Roma won 2-0, Gervinho getting the second goal, Dzeko getting the first on a dodgy penalty. Big win for them, they're close to the top of the table. In the Ruhr Derby, it was Borussia Dortmund who dominated. No Marco Reus, Aubameyang had a bad game, Hummels had an absolute stinker, and that's the only reason that Schalke scored 2 goals. But well done, Tuchel. Ginter, the left back, was exceptional, as was one Gonzalo Castro. And Lyon and Saint-Étienne, Lyon rolling to a rather comfortable in the end 3-0 win, but you're nodding along, so I'm glad I have your approval. It was a bit difficult because they decided to schedule that game at the same time as Fiorentina, or top of the league in Serie A. How cool is that? And of course, the Real Madrid Seville game, which Real Madrid lost. Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many, many thanks to my guests today, Tony Gascarino, Alison Rudd, and Julian Lorenz. Please press that subscribe button. We're going to be back next week. And remember, you can get exclusive football, rugby, and cricket highlights free as part of your subscription. It's just £12 for a 12-week trial. Just search The Times online and you'll find everything you need. Till next time, bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.